She's a research associate at the Urban Institute, and she's as well the process study director for the OZ demonstration. The title of the talk is Adapting a Two-Generation Service Model to Address Immigrants and Refugee Health. Please welcome Ms. Scott.
Hi there. As he just mentioned, I want to be talking to you a little bit about the HOST demonstration, which is a two-gen project to support whole families instead of just interventions with parents. And the thing that's interesting about it is that our sites are very diverse, so it has implications for kind of our developing demography throughout the United States, right? It's like a microcosm of what our country is looking like more and more. So this is just an overview of what I'm going to talk about. First, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the HOST demonstration itself and the evaluation that we have planned and that we are already implementing. Then describe some of the families to you that participate in the HOST demonstration. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about physical and mental health for the adults in these families, as well as physical and mental health of youth, 12 to 17 in these families, and then some of the lessons that we've learned along the way about developing these kinds of models. So first of all, as way of background, the HOST demonstration is really based on early experiences in public housing in Chicago. I don't know how many of you are familiar, but some years ago, the CHA, the Chicago Housing Authority, started its plans for transformation to basically demolish a lot of the most infamous public housing in that city. And it was famous for all sorts of awful conditions for people who were living there. And in that process, they found that there were some people who were getting left behind. So they were replacing the public housing with mixed income housing and vouchering people out. And there were folks that didn't meet particular criteria for moving out. And so they found that a lot of their distressed folks were getting left behind, and they needed to figure out how to support them. And so they started the Chicago Family Case Management Demonstration. And basically, the goal was just to help these people make that transition, and they found it in the process that just having somebody checking in with people on a regular basis, knocking on their door, and having multiple contacts with them every month made a really huge difference for the adults, and they actually saw a really unexpectedly positive results for physical and mental health, which they had not anticipated at all, and then also some effects in terms of employment. But what they didn't see were any effects for the children involved in those families. There was not trickling down to them. And so the HOST demonstration builds on that model from the Chicago Family Case Management study, and builds in supports for youth and children. And the idea is that you're trying to serve an entire family instead of just the head of household, which in a lot of ways is, you know, the focus on the head of household is very, you know, post-welfare reform, right? And the idea is that the whole family has to do well, and not just, you know, the only goal isn't just getting this person to work, but really supporting the whole family. And so in addition to those supports and developing a two-gen model, we have a formative evaluation. Formative evaluation is really different than traditional evaluation because you're really partnering with people who are doing the implementation and have an information feedback loop so that people can adapt things as they go along. I mean, we don't really know how to do two-generation models very well. That's something that's new, and so we don't want it to be so high stakes, right? Like, you did it wrong, and it's over, and we're going to defund you now, and we haven't learned any lessons from that. So there's constant conversation with both people who are participating in the program, people who are running the program, to adapt the model as it goes along. So the sites that are participating, so there's Alt Gill Gardens in Chicago, which is 100% public housing. It's on the south side of Chicago, and actually in a very isolated area. And it's very highly African-American, as I will show you in a second. There's Humboldt Gardens in New Columbia in Portland, Oregon. It has a very diverse population. I'll talk to you about them in a second. And then Benning Terrace, D.C. Housing Authority in Washington, D.C. And Brownsville in New York City is coming online as well. Alt Gill Gardens and the Portland site are the flagship sites, so they're actually did a full planning year and are just ending their second year of implementation. And as this research, there are different components to the kind of information that we're gathering. We have both a baseline and a follow-up survey that we're going to be fielding this next year. We work with the service providers to gather regular program data on employment outcomes, lease violations, those sorts of things. The survey allows us to capture a lot of things about health, right, both physical and mental health. And then we're also looking into working with Chapin Hall to gather administrative data about involvement with multiple systems for the families. And then we have the process evaluation. We have interviews with the providers, and we observe programs as well. We do focus groups with program participants, and next year we'll be doing in-depth interviews with both the adults and youth in the households. And then there'll be a cost analysis as well that'll be core to this. So most of the data that I'm going to be showing you today comes from the baseline survey. So this is just a description of the families. And the respondents to the survey were mostly female in both sites, although a little bit less so in Portland, about the same age, comparable across both of those flagship sites. And then we also had a separate youth survey for kids 12 to 17. And the response rates themselves were pretty high, but you'll notice that there are not as many kids 12 to 17 in Portland as there are in Chicago. Most of the children in the host demonstration in Portland are actually really little kids. So it's something to keep in mind. The numbers are particularly small for Portland in this case. So the statistical description I'm going to be giving you is pretty simple, probably the most appropriate since we're dealing with pretty small numbers of kids. So one thing to note is that those two flagship sites, their demography differs really drastically. So like I was saying, Portland kind of looks like what our country is evolving to be, right? We have a significant number of both Native Caucasians and African Americans, but there are African immigrants, there are Latin American immigrants, there are immigrants from Russia and some Asian countries. So there really is a very wide array of different racial and ethnic groups. And in Chicago, we're talking about mostly African Americans, although there are a spattering of other folks. But that makes for very different sort of service challenges in those two different places. And the host parents in the two sites are different in other ways, and a lot of that is driven by these differences, the inclusion of immigrant parents in the host demonstration in Portland. For example, the number of very large households is a lot greater in Portland. The folks who have, or the proportion of folks who have very low levels of education too, which can be a really serious barrier, even if you have good English language skills, is much higher in Portland as well. But the folks in Portland tend to have lower histories or shorter histories in public or subsidized housing. At the same time, the host families in both sites experience substantial economic hardships. I think this was a little bit surprising because the way that families were selected for the host demonstration is really different in the two sites. So in Chicago, they were by definition people who were not meeting their work requirements, so we expected that they would have really high levels of distress. And in Portland, a lot of folks thought, well, you know, these folks really are very resilient and they probably don't have the same level of difficulty as some of our more traditional public housing residents. And I think one of the things that comes through very clearly in looking at some of the information about economic hardships is that the families in Portland are struggling as much, if not more, in some areas. Like, so food insecurity was much more acute in Portland, and particularly among immigrant households. Work experiences were almost identical, which is kind of interesting. And they were both struggling with paying rent and utilities, although the issues were different in the two different sites, and some of that has to do with just sort of the payment structure for their subsidized housing. So question one, how do immigrant host parents compare to other host parents in the domain of physical and mental health? So what might we expect? I think many of you are probably very intimately familiar with the immigrant health paradox, that a lot of times folks who immigrate tend to have better health outcomes in particular defined areas, right? Although we know that folks like immigrants and refugees also experience really high levels of trauma in different parts of their life due to their experiences as a refugee or an immigrant. We also know that there's, in some communities, substantial mental health stigma and a real reluctance to talk about those issues. One of the host providers in Portland was talking about that in Somalia there wasn't even a word for depression, so it made it really hard to talk about those issues. He had to think about more creative ways of addressing those issues. And I know in my own work, in the past when we documented the effects of immigration enforcement on children and families, you know, the adults that we spoke to didn't talk about mental health issues. They talked about physical health and pain that they would experience, but like headaches and physical pain and that sort of trauma, because they didn't have the words to talk about in the sense of mental health. And then we know that immigrants often have lower rates of access to health care, low rates of health insurance, and engagement with clinical services. So what does the baseline survey tell us? Well, actually, in Portland, in terms of physical health, a higher proportion of immigrants rated their health fair or poor than the native folks in Portland, or the folks in public housing in Chicago, which is kind of interesting. And all of their rates are much higher than the rates that we see reported in the general population, which I think we would not be too surprised by. And in terms of depression, the rates among immigrants are similar to those in Chicago, but actually lower than the rates that were reported by native-born folks in Portland. I think one of the things that's hard about this is that we don't have enough people where we can do more segmentation by group, because I know that that would make quite a difference. And then there's also some gender differences in the sample. So question two, how do immigrant host youth compare to other host youth in the domains of physical and mental health? So again, what might we expect? We know that foreign-born children and the children of immigrants tend to have better health than native-born folks when they're smaller, but that goes away over time. Again, with the mental health stigma, parents may be reluctant to recognize or name the issues that they might have, and the lower rates of healthcare access, although they're better for children of immigrants because they can access many more programs than their parents in many cases. So youth with non-immigrant parents report worse health than ones with immigrant parents. So that seems to be kind of consistent with what we would see in the literature. Although I think one of the interesting things is that if you ask the youth how many times they've missed school for an illness, you see something that's very different. So you see actually really high rates relative to others of children of immigrants missing school for illness. So it may be that they don't report that they have health issues, but that maybe they're going unaddressed because they're not able to access health services or other things. So there's an interesting sort of irony there. And then in terms of the report of short-term anxiety and nervousness, they're really similar across Portland. The nativity didn't seem to matter very much, a little bit lower than they are in Chicago. But they're all much higher than what you see in the U.S. population of youth overall. And in terms of long-term anxiety, that was not something that immigrant youth reported at all. We had none reported it. In Chicago, it's off the charts. But again, that may be a question of how you ask that question more than an actual incidence. And it's hard to really tease out what the effects are. When we go out to do our qualitative interviews next year, I think it'll be a lot easier to capture those sorts of things. So the third question is, you know, how has the Portland site evolved to meet the needs of its really diverse families? I think that's been something that's been really challenging. So in year one, if you talk about the core coaching component, when I talk about coaching, I'm talking about the relationship between a coach and the parent mostly, right? Again, because of the assumptions that, you know, this population is lower need than the folks in Chicago, they won't need as much assistance. Their initial case ratios were actually much higher than Chicago's were for the demonstration. I think Chicago's were like 1 to 25 and theirs were 1 to 40. And they had very diverse coaches. They had a gentleman from Africa, another from Mexico, and an African-American woman. They were all working together. But they found out that there was much more need than they had anticipated. And actually, like what they found in the Chicago case management survey, or not survey, study, demonstration that they'd done earlier, the more contact you have with folks, the more you uncover, the more you realize that the needs are much more nuanced and sometimes more serious than folks would share in a more casual relationship. The other thing is that the families are much larger than they expected. I think they were a little overwhelmed. They were going to do a whole family model. Wow, you know, some of the families are very large and there are lots of people to serve. And they've figured out that they needed to have additional support, particularly for African women. The gentleman who was the coach, who was African himself and spoke many different languages, they realized that there was both a class and a gender issue with him, that he needed more support. There needed to be more people who could work with those parents to really adequately get them the support that they needed. And so in year two, they lowered case ratios. They hired an additional coach and redistributed the caseload, and they added a specialist to run an African women's group to deal with a wide array of issues. And then there's the youth component. You know, they have a very diverse, separate youth team. I think they have five or six different folks. And again, they're both very culturally diverse. And they all actually have MSWs, so they are more of a clinical team than the coaching case management folks. And so the first year, they were trying to target all of the kids. It was like 350 children. And they had a lot of low-intensity group activities, and they were finding that the interventions were spread too thin. The team was spread too thin. There wasn't much reason to think that it was going to be very effective. And so for year two, they really focused it much more methodically. They changed up their staffing, and they've been targeting elementary-aged kids, and they actually have assigned everyone a youth liaison, and they meet with the coach and the parents every month to coordinate, and they actually also liaise with the schools and talk directly with teachers and principals to help identify the issues that are coming up. So they've intensified the approach with a fewer number of kids to really try to make some progress. And particularly to address the health needs of immigrant families, like I mentioned, the African Women's Group has been really very helpful. They've also really strengthened the connections that they have with local refugee and immigrant organizations to connect them to resources. Again, leveraging the clinical expertise of the youth component staff. So at the beginning, there was so much... the coaching staff was integrating across two sites, and the youth group was trying to coordinate their services, but they really weren't working together in a wraparound sort of situation. And they've really come together a lot in the last year to do a better job of that and also sort of mitigate some of those class and language and gender issues that have come up. And they had a summer health fair, outreach and services for the uninsured and underserved. And they've been setting aside additional funds for clinical mental health services. So everyone knows it's a really huge gap in our system. And that's it.
So we'd like to thank all the presenters and all the individuals who came to this presentation. So now is the time for some of the questions. We had like a very diverse group. We had people talking about methodology. We had individuals talking about, you know, techniques. We have different groups. So I'm expecting several questions coming from this group. So who has the first question? Yes.
Well, thank you for this question because it clarifies the methodology. Time-space sampling has nothing to do with where people live. It has to do with where do they go to. Do they go to ethnic stores to buy their groceries? Do they go to a place of worship? Do they go to play soccer at a particular time? Do they meet at certain corners or certain places? So the methodology has nothing to do with where they live per se. It's not a household-based sampling, but it is where they go in their communities. So can we go to where they go and sample them there? Does that help? Is the question, have we found differences in terms of how long they have been here in the U.S.? To what? To how the technique works? Okay, that's why there are four phases. The first phase is to understand that particular population. If that population is new, you start to understand their way of living, where do they go, their congregation, and use that formative phase and that data collection phase to construct your sampling list of the places and the times. So a recent immigrant population may focus on ethnic stores more than they can focus on participation in community organizations. So you focus on where they congregate most of the time, where they go most of the time, and you build your sampling frame of venues and the time and days they go as the list from where you can send your staff to. If another population has been in the United States or in a particular state for a longer period of time, they may have a diverse set of venues where they go. Example, you may find them in community bookstores, or you may find them in gyms, or you may find them in cafes or barber shops. So your venues where you can find them is that first important part of the sampling methodology. And the time and the days would help you in developing and constructing your sampling frame.
Okay. Any other questions? I have like questions regarding the technique that you're talking about. Could you just elaborate on the timing and of the different phases? How long does it take to get those different phases? And if you have any examples of what you have already done regarding those using that time frame?
So in the time-space venue-based sampling, also known as time-location sampling, because it's the combination of both the place and the time, for example, 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock in the morning, you may go to a barber shop, but you may not find anybody if all the males are working. So you need to identify times and places where your population would be in that venue. In terms of the four phases, the first phase, the formative phase, where you are gathering information to understand your population better, it may take around 2 or 3 months. You may need staff that speak that language, that know that culture, that understand that population, to help you collect data from them or from key informants, or using any data that has existed before and analyze it. You may like to talk to a preacher. You may like to talk to a set of community-based organizations that serve them. That's the formative phase. It may take 2 to 3 months. The second phase, where you send staff to those venues that were identified by the stakeholders, it may take a month or two just to figure out, are those venues as successful as you have heard about them from the key informants? Are they going to give you the data you want to get once you start the sampling phase? The sampling phase is the data that really are used in the analysis. That could take anywhere between 6 to 12 months. Probably during every month you may collect data from around 50, 60 people. Depending on your sample size, you may need to collect data anywhere between 300 and 500 people. So depending on the number of staff, can you deploy them to those venues during those times? You can determine how long the sampling phase may take. And then the analytic phase may take 3 to 4 months. Is that helpful?
Yes. Thank you. Any questions come from the audience? Yes, the woman at the back, please.
I think I can remember everything you asked. The first question is, were all of the services provided in the VDS sites? And no. Primarily, a lot of education took place at the VDS sites, but there was community outreach done at other community settings, churches, work sites, health fairs, and other partners that these entities had relationships with, and also the mobile van in some of the communities. So there were a myriad of opportunities for outreach and education. The second part about expanding the project to other areas, our organization is breast cancer specific. So that I think this is a model, though, that could be used with other organizations. Certainly it's something that we wanted to, again, look at how our affiliates could best use this model across the nation. So I think it could be applicable for other health areas as well. And then your last question, it's failing me right now. Mm-hmm. Right. So part of the patient navigation and the, built into that was follow-up. And it was sometimes very challenging, particularly with this population because of numbers that you can no longer reach. So it really depended on how well connected the individuals were at the VDS that served as the patient navigators or community health workers were with the community. So that was one of the challenges that was reported by the grantees, is that sometimes it was difficult to actually do follow-up, but that was certainly part of the design of these patient navigation programs, was to do follow-up and understand if women actually receive services.
Question? I have a question from Ms. Scott. I just wanted to understand a little bit more about the rationale between comparing those two cities. You talked about Portland and Chicago. And what is exactly the rationale? And can it be done with any cities, or there was a specific rationale that you, if you could explain a little bit further, please?
Sure. I mean, the sites were selected, obviously not randomly, right? Chicago was obviously because the Chicago case management demonstration had been there before. There were really strong partnerships in place. The Portland Housing Authority was very strong capacity organization as well. So that was, those why are they're selected. For me, I think the thing that's really interesting is that in the world of sort of public housing and community development, I think there's really not a lot of awareness about the level of need in diverse communities, ones that are not long-term public housing residents. And I think that, you know, for me, looking at a lot of the statistics and saying, wow, you know, there's as much need or not as in a traditional public housing Ogdell Gardens community, is really very eye-opening. And I think it's important to be aware of those issues and also of the need to really adapt our service models. I mean, a lot of our policies and programs are based on, you know, paradigms from the 1960s, war on poverty, which are very black and white. And, you know, practitioners on the ground have adapted what they do and know that that's the case and have a lot of really great local knowledge about how to do that. That hasn't really bubbled up very well to national policy. And so I think that, you know, having the demonstration in sites that are so very demographically different really helps enlarge the conversation a little bit about needing to update some of our larger policies to adapt to our evolving demography.
Thank you. Any other comments or, you know, questions coming from the audience? So really, I would like to thank you for coming at this talk, and literally, I want to reaffirm and just remind all of you that this talk and this session was actually proposed by the Caucus on Immigrant and Refugee Health, and literally, this caucus is growing by the day. And I would like to encourage all of you, as the new chair of this caucus, to sign up or to give your email or to come talk to us at the end of this session. That way, we can have, you know, a diverse group in the next sessions, not only in the further years, but also trying to build a stronger section and a stronger caucus that could be maybe become a section. That way we can have a diversity not only in immigrant population that we're focusing on, but also diverse point of view and diverse methodology, as well as a different type of quality or qualitative versus quantitative studies. Once again, and as well as doing evaluation. So all of you are all welcome. Please come and talk to us at the end of this session. Thank you once again, and enjoy the rest of your APHA conference. Thank you.